Hello, and welcome to today's BTS Nest podcast. In this podcast, we interviewed Phil Botham, although we did this a little while ago, and a few things have changed since then, which I just want to clarify before we begin. Phil has been elected the Vice President, or was elected the Vice President of the BTS. He's now handed over his roles as an ambassador and a chair of the Public Comms and Skills Gap Projects. He is, however, still an active member of the Public Comms steering team. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the podcast.
BTS podcast here, run by The Nest, the network for early stage toxicologists. Today, we've got Dr. Phil Botham with us. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Right, I'm going to give you a very brief introduction and then we're going to get into it. So Dr. Phil Botham is currently a principal science advisor for Syngenta's Global Product Safety Organization, based at the company's International Research Center at Gellert Hill. From 2013 to 2017, he was a global head of product safety for Syngenta, managing a team of over 300 experts in human and environmental safety based mainly in the UK, North America and Brazil. Previously, he held a number of senior leadership roles in Syngenta and its legacy companies in the area of human safety and toxicology from 1980 until 2007 at the Central Toxicology Lab in Alderley Park and from 2007 at Gellert Hill. His broad background in chemical and agrochemical human safety, but has specific technical expertise in acute toxicity, sensitization, and immunotoxicology, including new approach methods and also the potential role for environmental exposure to chemicals in Parkinson's disease. Phil received his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Hull in 1978 and his Bachelor of Science in biochemistry from the University of Bangor in 1975. He's published more than 140 peer-reviewed papers and was appointed as a fellow of the Royal College of Pathologists in 2001 in recognition of his publication record in the field of toxicology. So in terms of your membership to the BTS, you've been a member of the British Toxicology Society for over 30 years and you're appointed a fellow of the BTS in 2006. You've made a number of presentations at various BTS meetings and also at SOT meetings as well. You continue to act the BTS ambassador within Syngenta, and you've also chaired the BTS Public Communications Steering Team, which is responsible for the commissioning and peer review of public statements, which are published on the BTS website as a regular activity of the society. So I think that pretty much does it for the intro, and that's a pretty dense introduction there as well. I wonder where you get the time to do all of this, first of all.
Well, yes, when you remind me of all of those things, it does feel like a lot. But of course, this is spanning a long period of time, over 40 years. So, it reads like a very dense set of activity, but it's taken many years to pan out.
Yeah, absolutely. So we mentioned that you've presented a couple of times at things like the BTS Congress more recently and also at SOT. Have you got any advice on presenting things? Because I know certainly it's something that we all have to do, I guess, at some point. And it's always good to get a bit of advice from people that are more experienced at it than ourselves, for sure.
Well, I'll tell you the first bit of advice is always make sure you're all really clear about how much time you've got, because I think one of the biggest mistakes that I've made in the past has been trying to put too much information into a presentation and finding that you run out of time. Actually judging how much you can talk about in whether it's a 15-minute or a 20-minute or a 30-minute talk is something which comes with experience. But generally speaking, my advice is, try to do less rather than more. And to really focus on the key points. And the other bit of advice I would give is practice. Have a go at presenting before you get to a conference with some trusted colleagues who will give you some good advice on whether what you're putting across makes good sense.
Yeah, it really is amazing, actually, sometimes how even just one run through of anything can really help sort of cement anything in your mind, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that maybe related to that, we're all experts in our field, whatever that might be. And we sometimes imagine that what is natural to us about understanding that field would be true for everybody else. So we sometimes say things, use acronyms, shorthand that we understand, but the audience may not. So always step back and say, what do I need to explain to make sure that I'm not leaving people behind in my presentation?
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I remember when I first came into the toxicology field, I just remember how many acronyms there are and how difficult it was to understand everything. I do have a question for you as well. So looking at your profile, it looks like you graduated with a biochemistry degree. So, I mean, that sort of like happens to a lot of us. Well, we sort of just accidentally stumble into the toxicology field. How did that happen for you then?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes, you're quite right. I mean, my first degree and my PhD were in biochemistry. But I was hoping after my PhD to do a postdoc in the same topic that my PhD was on. But as quite often happens even now, there was not enough grant money available to fund that. So I had to look for something else. And I wanted to stay geographically where I was for a little while. So I got the opportunity to move over to the discipline of immunology and did a postdoc in immunology for a couple of years. When I was recruited by ICI back in 1980, it was into a toxicology lab, CTL, that you talked about in the introduction, who were looking for people who could apply immunology in the area of toxicology. And, of course, immunotoxicology is what it's broadly now called. Although, specifically when I joined, I was more focused on specifically hypersensitivity, allergy, because there were, in those days, ICI had quite a number of occupational health issues related to exposure to chemicals and also to laboratory animals, which is a project I got involved in where technicians, people working on chemical plants were getting allergy problems, quite serious ones in some cases. So I got into toxicology through that route, very specialised, but somewhat coincidental.
So you mentioned your PhD was in a different field entirely. What was that field before you switched over, made the jump?
Well, my PhD was in microbial biochemistry. I was actually looking at the biochemical mechanisms that lay behind the fact that some types of yeast were able to produce very high content of lipid fat. This was in the days of early biotechnology when there was a hope that single cell organisms like yeast could become a source of nutrition, both lipid and protein. And so I was on the lipid side. The postdoc I hoped to do was to take that further and to more move it towards a sort of commercialization through a better understanding of the biochemistry.
Fabulous. I mean, I suppose to an extent, all of the fields all across biochemistry and pharmacology all feel sort of feed into toxicology to an extent. Toxicology always seems like a very broad church of lots of different sort of disciplines sort of focusing on a particular issue together, for sure.
Yes, that's right. And you mentioned one of the things that I'm currently doing, which is chairing the group looking at the skills and training gap that there currently is for toxicology, not just in the UK, but we're focusing on the UK. And that's reinforcing that very point, Jamie, that yes, there is a need for sometimes specific training in toxicological science on all its subdisciplines. But actually, the fundamental requirements quite often for people entering into that field can come from a variety of places, both biological and chemical and mathematical. So there are lots of base science skills which are needed and which can be translated in the same way that I translated into toxicology.
Touching on those skills gaps, particularly in the UK at the moment, have you been able to identify any skills gaps which young toxicologists could potentially plug?
We think the key gap at the moment is in what we call regulatory toxicology, which again is a very broad discipline. But we think that, for example, both industry and government authorities are really at the moment struggling to find people who have got the skills and the experience, and actually sometimes even the motivation, because perhaps they don't really understand what the roles are about, to be a regulatory toxicologist. It sounds less exciting perhaps than being a research toxicologist. With lots of new exciting science being developed and gradually being incorporated into regulatory toxicology, of course, when you just talk about regulatory tox, people think it's maybe a bit old-fashioned, maybe not as exciting, not an area where your career might flourish. But actually, that's not true, and because regulatory toxicology is a very broad range of activities, ranging from the application of deep science to understanding the safety of chemicals, for example, right the way through to actually understanding regulation and working in regulatory authorities, making decisions on the safety of a pharmaceutical or the safety of a chemical. So fantastic opportunities in regulatory toxicology, but we because regulations are continuing to increase and become more sophisticated, the skills gap is widening.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, today I think we're both regulatory toxicologists by trade on here in terms of us guys on the Nest podcast team here as well, but I hear you there. It's not seen perhaps as, for want of a better word, as sexy as other fields in toxicology, for sure. And I could see why regulatory might be seen as a bit droll, perhaps. But equally, I think there's an element, particularly within the regulatory toxicology, obviously, what you're doing there has an almost political angle. As you work with regulators, I think that side of things is you start to see science sort of emerge from, you know, research facilities and labs and academia and actually apply itself to the wider world through regulatory toxicology, of course. I find it interesting, at least from a political perspective.
I think people use this phrase NAMs, new approach methods, a lot. The fact is that whilst that is indeed a lot of the really exciting and innovative science that is being done, increasingly that is being applied into regulatory toxicology. And it is the future, a future where we can make more accurate assessment of risk to human health or risk to environmental safety. So I really do believe that if people have doubts about regulatory toxicology as a path to take, if you're in research tox at the moment, there definitely is a place for your skills in the future.
Yeah, I think it's possibly a little bit more than box ticking exercises, although It certainly it sometimes can feel like it's just those at times, but yeah. If you'd be willing to answer a big dumb question here, when do you think we'll be at a point where we no longer have to do any in vivo testing, if that's even possible?
Right. Well, of course, one particular sector, the personal care cosmetic sector, has already faced that challenge for quite a long time. And I have to say that going back to what we've just been talking about, if you speak to people from that sector, it's absolutely amazing the way in which they've used new approach methods, new science, innovative science to really make sure that they can continue to do their work of making sure that the compounds that are used or the products that are used in personal care are safe for use. Yes, there's some people might argue that actually if we were to ban the use of animals in safety assessment today, wouldn't that bring innovation through more quickly? My answer to that would be that actually at the moment, I think it would be very difficult for us to really be certain about safety, certain types of safety assessment, if we were not able to use experimental animals. But I do applaud those who would like us to move more quickly. And I know that some regulatory authorities have been thinking about whether they should be setting deadlines to say after this point we will no longer be expecting or accepting animal-based toxicology tests. I mean, the US Environmental Protection Agency a couple of years ago, for example, we're using 2035 as a tentative date for that. Well, that's slipped a little bit, but I really do think that we should be certainly moving in that direction as quickly as we can, but not at the expense of making bad decisions and putting people's health at risk or threatening the safety of our wildlife and environmental safety generally.
Yeah, I mean, you see some aspects of it being replaced slowly by alternative assays. I'm thinking the I can't remember it at the moment, but it's all about taking small steps, isn't it? Certainly, some of the standard regulatory endpoints that you get for things like reproductive and developmental toxicity, you know, it feels like those are possibly a long way off because. Obviously, they're quite complex to model in any sort of way, meaningfully.
Yes, that's right. I think that particular set of endpoints that you call reproductive developmental tox, I think, yes, people do think that is the biggest challenge we have at the moment for being able to replace the current animal testing. But there is work being done to bring that forward more quickly, and I think it will be in time. It will be possible for us to at least to do more in vitro in silico than we're currently doing.
Yeah, I think that sort of brings back to the point that you were saying as well. We have so many research toxicologists who are looking to replace all these animal testings, in vivo testings, but it also sort of it's the regulatory toxicologist's responsibility to be able to implement all these experimental toxicologists have been doing in order to sort of, you know, like you said, push NAMs and or have more people understand the applications of NAMs and the plausibility of using NAMs to replace all these traditional animal testings.
Yeah, I think it's a really important point too, to building on that, to make sure that those people who are working in the area of NAMs in the research toxicology more broadly, ever increasingly using more the new science and the new approaches, and to be able to talk to let's call them the traditional regulatory toxicology community in a way in which that the value of that science either now in some cases or in the future can be properly understood, because I think sometimes we kind of don't talk the same language. We hear all this the scientific research that's going on, often at BTS and SOT meetings, but we don't necessarily fully understand it. Sometimes it's the acronyms that get in the way, as we said earlier. And I think we do need, and this is something that societies like the BTS can and should be doing, we do need to make sure that there's a common understanding, and because I think that will facilitate faster implementation of new and perhaps better science into regulatory toxicology in the future.